So in looking at people and talking with people in basic interview, they may be interviewing me, but I'm interviewing them. And I don't really want to get involved in a lot of things. I've done some isolated projects for some individual things and different things. I did a small consulting thing for Jeff Gordon Wines, which is the NASCAR racer.
All right.
Yeah, just gave them a small little consult on some stuff.
Okay.
And there'll be occasionally some others. Mm-hmm. But the involvement with the Scotto family and the J. McClellan Wines and now the Lost Chapters Wines,
right,
which I find to be really, I really like the Lost Chapters program because it's the ultimate flexibility and fun to do what you want to do.
And they're delicious, by the way.
Yeah.
Just to them.
Yeah, well, that's it. I have a thing that you can't attach my name to something that I wouldn't be involved with. If you're going to bottle something, my name's not on the cork if it's not something that I want or it's not in the publicity or anything. I won't do that. It has to be world-class style wines.
Right. And well-priced, too.
Yes. Well, they are well-priced. To my reason, they're almost a little too well-priced. As I tend to show, when things are underpriced, you can hurt yourself just as badly as overpricing.
And that's wise.
So, anyway, so that program is, I like the freedom and flexibility. I was known for making a lot of wines. I was told by people who worked for me and others that there were a couple of years where I made and bottled maybe as many as 50 wines.
Wow.
Under different brands and different programs. But they were there.
Right.
And we did a lot of different things. Writers tend to want to put a handle on you. You're known for doing this, you're known for doing that. They don't think you can do more than one thing. There's phrases that, you know, that were out in the publicity that Mitch never met a grape he didn't like. That's not true, but that was done by somebody for PR things that says that. It does say, yeah, I do probably enjoy more different grapes, varieties, and styles than most winemakers because I understand the need for that. I'm not locked into my own little world.
Mm-hmm.
When people talk about, well, it's kind of interesting. When people didn't know that I was not with my original winery, I would get emails and texts and phone calls and whatever, however, letters, saying, you know, what happened to this wine? Why is that wine different? This is different. You know, and I'm not making judgment on the wines that are being made there today and the same labels. It's that I have to tell people, it's different winemaker,
mm-hmm.
different vineyards,
mm-hmm.
because I use most of all my old vineyards. Different facilities. The wines aren't made there. They're made at other places now because they own a lot of different wineries. And I go, it's going to be different. And so some of the, like, social things on Facebook, somebody had gotten into a thing about, you know, why are these wines, why are the Cosentino wines different? Well, they're different, you know, I mean, there are certain wines that they tend to try to follow style, but they're different. They're going to be different. The point was that somebody coined the phrase, they're not Mitch wines. And they said, well, what do we do? Said, well, if you want to get niche wines, you have to go to Pure Cru. And that's how somebody, and I don't remember who, I think one person, but I'm not sure exactly who came up with it. But so Mitch wines have a style, but they have a style that has different styles to making them. But it has to do with balance and brightness
but they should be because you have different fruit sources like you
yes.
described. So why should they be identical? Have to be in an alcohol.
Right, right. The one thing about Mitch wines is though that they're always going to have good acidity, I guess.
There's bread.
Yeah, and flavor,
mm-hmm.
but flavor of the vineyard and the variety, not artificial flavors. which there's, I hate to say it, but most wines that are made today have some artificial characteristic to them.
Was it because...
And I'm not saying Napa either. Right. I'm not saying... No. Although that's going, some of it is going on here and there.
But that sameness isn't a marketing ploy that people expect similarity, so that's what is being catered to?
Well, sure. But to do, you know, it's the old approach in the world that if, you know, the Gallo approach was to make everyone the same. You have to do that through the lab. You're not going to do that through, you know, and in want commercial wines in different places, you're gonna find that. In Napa, where vineyard and vintage play a key role, you may have a somewhat of a house style, which may be related to oak or certain types of fermentations and, you know, commonness of certain things. You're still gonna have variations that may be stylistically similar.
Right.
But there's a lot involved in that. And as long as it's world class, has the ability to age and evolve, you know, and develop, and is true to the grapes it's made from, that's important to me.
So the uniformity you advocate is quality, essentially. Quality and
quality
balance.
And balance, but also and correct direction of where the grapes are from. I mean, you're never going to have an Alexander Valley Cabernet that's going to taste like an Oakville Cabernet or an Oak Knoll Cabernet or a Rutherford Cabernet. But those Rutherford, Oakville Cabernet, you may find some commonness among producers in those appellations. Then the differences become your balance points. Some people make them with lower acidity because that became kind of a common thing among writers and publications. They wanted lower acidity and higher pHs. Why, I'm not sure, but...
Because they're not in production.
Yeah.
And they don't understand.
And so, and then oak treatment. What is your oak regime? You know, it's amazing, you know, how many, you know, I always tell people, if the oak is the first and the most prominent thing you see, then it lacked other character when the oak has to become the prominent.
And you said something interesting, the myth about not all oak tastes the same, within the same cooperage, within the same category of oak, that there's quite a bit of variability.
You have, yes, even in the same exact barrel type, because it's being made from trees.
Right.
And those forests, in the same forest, you can have two trees next to each other, and they may theoretically be the same and similar.
Yeah.
I don't think we know all of the answers. I can just tell you what the result is. I can tell you that when people tell you that a barrel that's maybe 4 or 5 years old is neutral, not all neutrals are equal. I can, and I used to show people for years that I had a barrel, a white barrel from 1982 that I bought from Markham Winery after it had one wine in it that they did a barrel bottling on, and I loved that wine, and I loved the barrel. And then I ended up, I bought a case of that wine. It was actually a 20-some case bottle. But there was something about that wine that attracted me to it. The next year, I was still in Modesto. I had bought a bunch of new barrels because I was expanding some stuff, but I had all new barrels. I needed older barrels. So I'm out shopping for older barrels, more mature barrels. Markham had an ad in one of the wine things that they had some barrels. I drove up there, I looked at them, they really looked like I wanted, and I needed 24, 25 barrels, whatever it was. I went through and found, smelled, and, you know, looked at them with the flashlight and checked them all out, and I'll take that one, this one. And I had like, I'm missing one, I need one more barrel. But I was looking for barrel 365, the barrel that made the Chardonnay. And so finally I said, guys, this will fit me with one more barrel, but you have to find one barrel for me, otherwise I may have to look elsewhere. Now let me know. I said, I need barrel 365. I'm in there with cellar guys. They're going, I had found barrel 366. And looking around, trying to find, well, where's barrel? And they go, we can make any of these barrels number 365 if you want. I said, no. I said, you don't understand. I need barrel 365. There's, and it's that barrel, not barrel number 365. And anyway, they found barrel 365 and bought the barrel. That wine, that barrel continued in white wine production, Chardonnay production, for 24 vintages.
That's remarkable.
It was never neutral. I didn't know that when I was buying.
Sure.
The barrel 366 was neutral. Barrel 365 never was neutral. It had its own situation. It was its, and it developed its own character. And when you go through and taste the new, and I would taste with barrel people. You know, because they, you know, and they'd come in and I'd taste, let's taste it. We'll taste it. Well, wait a minute, what's this barrel? This is not, I thought we were tasting the neutral barrels. Oh, yeah, that's a 1982 barrel. And this is like in the 90s. It's a what?
It had a personality all its own.
It developed its own personality. That's what I used to tell people. I told people barrel was and other winemakers. I go, this is a lesson to be learned because we don't know everything. Nobody had a reason. Nobody knew why it was different. And it was, and it was, and its own character. Finally, I had to retire. It's in my garage now, been nailed together and shrunken because it's not in one. So it's like a shrunken head. It's kind of.
It's a tribute.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a display barrel I used after that for a few years. Yeah. So anyway. Barrel regimes make a difference, and doing everything by, and the big wineries, and I say big, anybody other than really small,
yeah,
has a formula.
That's why making by committee.
Yeah, because they can't do it all themselves. They have to do it. It's formula. It's time.
Yeah.
You crush. You usually make the crush them at that time, although you will have some allowances there. But we blend in February, we bottle in March, or, you know, whatever, for whatever wine. We don't do that. And that's what these people that I work for and consult with have to understand. The wine has to tell you when it's ready. And it has to know when it's time to go.
So this is a wisdom and depth of experience that
cannot
be in any way replicated, replaced, you know, fast forwarded. It's really something you observed.
Yeah, and I think people and winemakers have had assistants in lab techs and they became winemakers and stuff like that. You know, all scattered all over the place. But I think that's one thing that I always am stressed with everybody. That, you know, if you're gonna be in fine winemaking, I know you have to work with ownership and management, because when they go on to different things, but you got to also learn that the wine is telling you something too. You know, like, you know, I don't know if it's still done, but I remember Opus came in and every wine would go into new barrels and go into their lower cellar, that underground, supposedly temperature controlled cellar that wasn't. Was built on a hot springs.
Yeah.
That was, that's probably not widely known, and maybe we shouldn't make a big public thing about it. But they had to go back in and spend a fortune to then bring it to control. So the engineers probably had to pay for some. There was probably some insurance policies built by some of the designer engineers or ground people. That was a mess. But anyway, it's a beautiful cellar. I'd love to be able to make wine in that cellar. But then after a year, they rack it into more neutral barrels. I mean, this is the way it was. It could be very different now. I'm just telling you at one point, many years ago. And then, you know, and that was I think for the second year, and then it would be bottled before the third year. Everybody wants to bottle before the third year. Why? Because you have to have, to go 3 years, you have to have 50% more space, 50% more barrels, and of course you're gonna have your money tied up for longer too, except for some of them do barrel age long, or bottle age longer, but nowadays, I mean, people are selling 16 Cabernets right now. They were selling 16 Cabernets in 18. I haven't bottled my 15 yet. So, you know, it's why? Because the wine's telling me that. Now, 2018 is a year that might tell me that it wants to go a little earlier. Judging by what I'm seeing, but was still phenomenal balanced structure. We're not seeing, we're seeing a more effusive character coming out of it, that's more than any vintage I've ever seen. So we'll see, but that decision won't be made for a while.
Some of the remarks you made really align with that of Andrew Chelicho's philosophies. Has he influenced your...
Well, you know, indirectly,
yes.
Actually.
Okay.
I was proudly honored the Andrea Telichev Winemaker of the Year in 2002 or 2003. I knew Andre, but not as well as the people who worked for him. In fact, I had a very classic lunch with him and Jerry Mead at the Sardine Factory in Monterey. I think it was during the Monterey Wine Festival one year. And that was before smoking was not allowed inside, before they moved it all outside, before it went, you know. And those two were very prolific smokers. And I'm not a smoker. And that was a real struggle. But we talked about a lot of things, and I'd always been a fan of his wines. Not only what he had done with BV and the people he directed, but other projects that he had some ties to.
Sure.
And I remember telling him, because my favorite winemaker from the pre-golden era was John Daniels, who was the winemaker at Inglenook,
sure.
Who was Robin Lael's father of Lael Vineyards. John made phenomenal wines, especially in the 60s, the 50s and 60s, those wines. You go through and taste those wines, they're just, they were as good as anything that Bordeaux was making.
Wow.
And I think I mentioned to Andre, I said, I've always been a great respect for you and your rival, John Daniels. And he said, oh no, we were very good friends. We were really good friends. I said, well, you guys were the guys. And
the piece that you shared about listening to wine, as I said, aligns perfectly with Andrew's core philosophy that you let the wine dictate the rules and force upon. So a big part of your palatal development, if you will, from what you shared with me, is your tasting calendar, and I say in quotes because it's your journey that took you to many wine regions and through many iterations of different varietals. You spoke how extensively you taste on a regular basis and how it shaped your views. Tell us about that.
Well, in the 80s, while I was, my good friend who had the wine shop, he really represented high-end stuff, and all the brokers and distributors would call on him because he had customers, he knew where to go with it. And he basically wanted me at all his buy tastings. And so he would do most of them in the evening, which frustrated some people that wanted to call on him, or it would be late in the afternoon, because he had, at the time, he also owned a bar that was a whole nother business. And so, he would generally do most of his stuff late afternoon and then in the evenings. And but it was convenient for me, too. I mean, I couldn't make them all, but I would do quite a few. And when there were certain people coming in, he said, oh, so-and-so's coming in, and he's going to have all the new blah, 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 we got to fine. So when can you do it on? I said, yeah, but I need to, I can't get there till like 6:30 or something. Said, fine, I'll let them know when we're getting there. And that's how things kind of evolved and developed. And I was tasting, you know, over 5,000 wines for several years. I don't taste that many right now, but I still do taste into the thousands. I don't know exactly how many. I've not as been as active as counting them. But I'm also involved, I get involved with a lot of other things. I try to do, like this year, I've got to find out if I can make the tastings in, some of them in San Francisco, like the big Italian tasting. What? Yes, Trebicchieri. Yeah. That is one of the best public tastings. Not public, it's actually commercial. It's not for the public. But that's one of the best broad tastings I've ever done.
And what does it contribute to your education, if you will? What value do you get out of tasting other people's wines?
You never stop learning, and you always want to see what goes into making certain things. How certain areas and varieties and blends work. Even though I do so much experimentation, I used to do just countless experimentation. It's all part of the education. What is this? If you don't know about it, where does it go? I've been making Nebbiolo, for example, because a little grower, backyard vineyard, on Napa Street or whatever it is in Sonoma County, east of the square, came to me because he had seen my, at the old company I had the US flag and the Italian flag as an homage to my heritage. And they had seen it and they came in one day and says, hey, I've got a little old Italian. I'm growing Nebbiolo and I make some wine out of it and all that. I'd like to sell you some grapes. I'd like to see you make some of this wine. I'm going, Nebbiolo? I didn't know anybody had Nebbiolo in this country. I mean, it had a very finicky reputation anyway. Well, I learned more as I said, great. In the mid-90s, I was paying more for Nebbiolo than I was paying for Napa Valley Cabernet. Wow. A ton. Because it was all there was, this little lot. And see, what I did is I got him to talk to the other little Italian guy across the street who grew produce and some grapes to plant Nebbiolo, and between the two of them I might have enough to make some. It was tough. A barrel, two barrels. So between the two of them, I mean, I was paying like $3,500 a ton for Nebbiolo. I mean, everybody thought I was crazier than anything. And I could only make a little bit of it. It was and you couldn't make a bottled version every year. Over the years, in a 10-year period, if you were lucky, you could bottle 5 vintages. So it was a great risk, too. So I would blend it into something else or whatever. But anyway, it was a real education. You want to learn about these kind of things. So I did it experimentally, but it got me a fair amount of attention. People knew I made Nebbiolo those minstrel. I bottled it in 500s so I could get it out to people.
Sure.
Of course, we sold it for $35 to $38 for a 500.
Right.
And tall, skinny Italian bottle. So anyway, in 2003 or 2004. I was approached by somebody representing the Italian government to ask me to come to Italy to speak on the first World Conference on Nebbiolo.
Well, how about that?
On them for a week. And apparently they had discovered, they had found, they went through and did some research to find who was making Nebbiolo. Mm-hmm. Somehow I was listed somewhere. And around the world. And they were visiting, apparently they had visited the winery. They had gone out and
sleuthed.
Yeah. to find who was, and find stuff that was represented. And wham, this came, this invitation.
That must have felt good.
So you go there, so my girlfriend at the time and myself, we flew there for a week in northern Italy, but it wasn't Piemonte. The grape originated, as far as their research and everything, in Valtellina. And the first World Conference was held in Valtellina, and the Piemonte people had to come to Valtellina for the conference and the tastings and all that. And I remember, and then I had to speak. So what my whole deal was, I had to bring a case of wine over there for the tasting. And I had to speak at the conference for a few minutes. That was, for that, I got to spend a week in northern Italy.
That was a good deal.
Yeah, in January of all things, believe it or not, when it's cold and snowy. But what's interesting is that event, I took a glass up onto the thing, and everybody's wearing the translator helmets. Hundreds and hundreds of people, I don't know how many people, maybe 1,000 or so, I don't know. Anyway, I raised the glass and I toast. I said, I want to toast to you who make a living off this variety, because I have learned they're contrary to anybody's thoughts in my country, where they think Pinot Noir is the hardest wine to make and the hardest grape to grow. It is not remotely close to Nebbiolo, because there is no grape harder to grow. I tried to grow it in Yountville, couldn't grow it, and everything grows in Yountville. And to make that wine on a consistent basis, I mean, the world owes you, the producers in this country, for this grape, because it's so hard to make in the purest form anywhere else. And because of that, when I do it, I only bottle wines that will be the wines that can be represented in an event like this. If not, I do not bottle them. And so I was a hero to them.
Wow, that's a very inspiring story.
And what was great is one of the wineries held their Sforzat, because in Valtellina, Sforzat is their highest level wine. But to get it to full body table wine, they have to put it in drying trays.
Wow.
In these little stone places that they build, some of them right in the vineyard, in the air with nets. And they held one of the producers held some of that from crushing until we were there, and then they crushed it right after the conference.
That is so wonderful.
Which was in January. So they didn't crush that vintage, it was 2004 vintage, I think, until 2005. But that gave us, and there was a winery from New Zealand, and there was a winery from the Central Coast, and there was from another European country, and all that they had researched out and found to pour and be there at this event, along with all the Italian producers. And so to show off everything, they had a bus and they took us on some tours of wineries. Those people in Valtellina, I left one guy, I was like wanting to cry. He's out there, he's so proud, he's just barrel-chested guy, and he's out there, and the bus is pulling out, and he walked out, and he's got this big wave, this big slow-motion wave as we're leaving. And the next generations don't want it. They have trouble with people because the next generations don't want to work. And in Valtellina, all the vineyards are on the side of the hills in these little terraced areas, and some of them may only have 40 vines on them, and then you have to go to another terrace, and it's all on southern exposure. All the commercial wines are on the hill, exposed to the south, and all the grape on the main highway. And people share the vineyard, like in Burgundy.
Yep.
A little bit, they share the blocks or terraces. On the south side, the only grapes you see on the south side, which you could see at that time of year, were covered in snow. Didn't have the sun exposure. And those are not, those are homemade wines. Those are for local people. They're not the commercial. The commercial ones all run. So Vault Wine is a very special place. And I've always encouraged people, if you really are into the variety, it's one thing to go to Piedmont, it's another thing to go to Vault Wine. So anyway. So that was one of those interesting. So you always want to learn. I test grapes to learn what can be done. You know, I had a Pinot Grigio from a vineyard in Lodi. No, in Susun Valley, or Ryer Island, and because I made them both. That we didn't take the color out of it. We picked it to brightness. People realize, but Pinot Gris or Pinot Grigio, it's not white. It's really kind of an orange texture to it. The grapes look gray on the outside. It's like some Gewurztraminer can look.
Genetically, it's related to Pinot Noir?
Yes. So anyway, I entered one in the Los Angeles, International Wine Competition in the limited production category. And it won Best White Wine, limited production. And when people found that a Pinot Grigio won Best White Wine, limited production, they go, what's going wrong with this judging? And then you taste the wine, and it's like, it's a different deal, fuller body.
Sure.
Didn't carbon strip the color out, or did we pick it, pre-20 bricks to make sure there was no color?
So.
No, anyway, and we're actually making one right now. For the Scottish,
yeah.
I don't know how it's going to go under. I don't. It's going to be out of Sonoma Valley or Susan Valley, and it really gets
kind of elevating the category.
Yeah, well, but the Oregon did it first.
Yeah,
they were doing it first. I used to do the International Pinot Noir celebration and pour there. In fact, my '94 Russian River Pinot became known in Burgundy because of the Burgundy winemakers there that were at that event that year. And then some of the big Testament Society collectors that have it to this day. But I told people, some of the Oregon people, I go, you guys are missing the boat, because it was very variable, especially in those days, more so than even now. Vintage to vintage in Oregon was, five vintages, two great vintages a decade, maybe three, four to five usable, okay vintages, and then using two or three that could have been a disaster. I said, you guys were the first ones to do a Pinot Gris. You developed a character, and you almost apologized for making it. And this would be, I said, California, they're not making Pinot Grigio or Gris now. I said, you have it by the tail. Make it your big deal. Make your living off of this wine, because it's good enough to do that. And make your, keep the wine and make your bonus years on the great vintage Pinot. Forget these other things, you should do that. And they all thought I was like goofy or shit. But about two or three years ago, I had two people come to me in different sign situations and say, because I told them, I said, I'm going to make Pinot Gris in California. But when the other guys start making it in California, they're going to blow you out and nobody will even know you exist. And I said, change the state laws so that you don't have to call it Pinot Gris, that you can call it Pinot Gris or Pinot Grigio. Mm-hmm. They thought it was beneath them. I go, well, you're going to learn the hard way. They learned the hard way. Came to California, taken over, and now people don't even, unless you know Oregon wines, they don't even know it's made there. But they had the lead and they were by themselves. And they didn't make it work. And so two or three years ago, two people at different times and places came up to me and said, I remember when you were down at the International Pinot Noir Celebration and you told the Oregon people, and one of them was an Oregon producer, and told us that we needed to pay attention and really claim that. And we really didn't do it, did we? I said, no, you didn't. He says, and we kind of lost the category. Yes, you did.
Yeah.
And
I'm in full agreement with you. When I attended that same celebration, I tasted some phenomenal Pinot Gris, and I was wanting the same thing. Why haven't they taken over the category? Clearly, you advised them earlier.
I I've tasted those wines because I have a good doctor friend of mine that has a house in Salishan, in Lincoln City, Salishan.
Mm-hmm.
It's a getaway place that he shared with somebody else. And so I'd go up there and visit with him, or I'd even if I was headed up somewhere, say, here's the keys, just lock it up when you're done, you know? And I'd go up there and I'd visit wineries and taste, and I'd always bring bottles home.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd go, these are great wines, and we're not making them here.
Some of the most interesting wines are the least known. You touched briefly upon the next generation with respect to Italy, but I'm curious in general, you clearly are now in the mentorship role. So when you speak to the next, you know, wave of winemakers, vintners, viticulturalists, or when you work with them directly, what are some of the life lessons that you impart? What is the most instructive about your life experience that you talk about?
Don't get lost in the lab. Know your chemistry, but don't let it rule you. Live with the grapes if you can. I mean, some people are just going to be production people and never get out in the year. I've always told people, and people who work for me know, that during harvest, I spend most of my time in the vineyard. Out there looking, seeing, smelling, tasting, chewing the grape. The lab numbers on grape samples are just a guide, you know, but you learn the flavors. Not everybody can do that, because not everybody has the palate sharp enough to do that. And it's hard to do, and it's sometimes hard to tell people that what they can do and what they can't do. But you can taste what you can see. But never be afraid to be creative. Never be afraid to challenge something if it makes sense. Always take a common sense approach to everything. There is no common sense anymore, or very little in a lot of places. And be your own person.
Don't be a populist. Stay true to who you are.
Yeah. And taste a lot of wines. Don't just taste your own. Taste everybody's. Taste wines from a region you're focused on, but taste wines, great wines, that other people do from other places. You may find an awakening you shouldn't miss. And everybody can still create their own ground. Everything's been done. We're still learning. And then I tell them about the 24-year-old white barrel that everybody thinks they know what's going on. And everybody said, well, how do you explain it? I said, I don't explain it other than we don't know everything. And once somebody thinks they know everything, they're lost. And you'll shoot right around those people.
One of the hallmarks of your career clearly is a staunch work ethic and constant learning curve. Do you feel that those values still exist? Are they continuing on, or?
Well, you look for passionate people. Passionate people will have those characteristics and tendencies.
You're hopeful about this generation of?
Oh yeah, I think. Oh, there's a lot of people that want to get in the wine business. They want to do it. I think a lot of people see the art. Now, a lot of people that buy facilities or buy property and put their name on, they just want to see their name on something. That's a bad reason. It's a very bad reason.
It's a tough business too, so.
Sure it is. But I have talked to a lot of people, oh, I came in because I don't care if I make any money on it. I've made my money in other things, blah, 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 blah. I go, well, you realize that you're going to have people, yeah, and you're going to spend money, and you're already spending a lot of money on a lot of things. Probably more than you need to, I told people. Because you listen to Robert Parker advise you to hire a certain
dream team
that, you know, caters to him. some of those people will get you in trouble. Some of those people will lose your money. But if you don't care about losing money, that's one thing. All along, I'm saying that, I'm knowing that these people are not people who like to lose money. They didn't make fortunes to lose money. So, what they all then come back, and I said, and you're gonna be involved. Well, I have the best team. I'm gonna have this thing. Yeah. 2 years later, I'm like, I can't believe how much work I got to put in this. I'm putting so much work into this thing. I'm retired. I gotta go to New York and do a series of this and that. I gotta do that. I go, welcome to the wine business. That's what you have to do. So that's not, you know, it's all about, I mean, there were people putting names on labels. I don't want to pick on this name in particular, although I think it's now a label owned by somebody else. Michelle Schlumberger. There's a name that didn't have to be on the label. I mean, you're gonna cultivate a small amount of people, but don't expect that brand to be, because nobody's gonna, they can't spell and pronounce my name right. And my name really is pretty simple by some standards. That's why I didn't even put my name on my first wines. So, you know, eventually I switched because industry people, distributor people, Robert Mondavi's first distributor was a distributor over in the North Bay. And he came to me and he was my first distributor. And he says, Robert Mondavi doesn't call his wine or something else, why are you? And I said, well, my name, he said, you've been in it now 4 or 5 years. Yeah, you have this one series with your name on it. This is your brand, it needs to be you. You're the person. Hmm. So, I eventually switched. But in a lot of cases, I didn't do it to put my name on light. That was my point. Okay. Now, and I, like I said, there's worse names than Michelle Schlumberger. Spell and pronounce and get right, but from a marketing standpoint.
Sure.
So, but some people just want to see the name on the label, or they want the pride to say, oh, this is my one. It's great. You know, designing and building the world's whatever that everybody knows you for wasn't important enough now that you want it. You have to have your wine, your name on the wine.
That's a bad.
It's not a good thing.
Romance.
Yeah, it's the romance. So anyway, so that's part of it. You need people that are in there for passion. There's a lot of people, young people, a lot of women now getting into winemaking. And I see it as a more passionate endeavor. It's not getting a lab job. Mm-hmm. You know, oh yeah, I have a degree in laboratory whatever things, you know. Something science. But if you're getting into winemaking, and you want to be a winemaker, there are winemakers that want to work as a job because
right.
They know that trade. And then there's people that want to make wine.
And they're all there.
Yeah, and those are different people.
You touched upon the media, which of course we all know can be a friend or foe, but given the current state of affairs, which in my view has changed dramatically and very rapidly, and I'm not even talking about the digital piece of it, I'm talking about the entire perception of what wine writing and perhaps wine influencing is. What are your thoughts on that?
Wait a minute, let's go through that again. Yeah. Start that again. Let me just rethink that into pieces because you kind of took it around.
Yes, I put a lot in there.
Yeah.
So you're clearly, through the span of your career, you've been exposed to a lot of media members, the writers, that there were far fewer in numbers, but
right.
They went, you know, into great depth.
They were no less prominent than today's noted writers for their time.
Right.
But they were fewer, yes.
And it sounded like, although they didn't get all the facts right, and that's unfortunately, you know, a constant peril, they took a more thoughtful approach to their craft. Would that be a correct statement?
Without trying to insult a lot of people today, the good ones were very good.
Okay.
And yes, I mean, they lived every moment of what they did. Now, I'm not saying that that doesn't happen today, but you got to put a lot into it, and there is no simple way of doing it. But there's still a lot of really good writers.
Yeah.
But the problem is, some of the publications, some of the writers are always looking to make a discovery.
Huh.
It's sensationalism, which unfortunately now permeates all media.
Right.
And so they're looking, they're not looking for the little unique story of all of them. They're looking for something to sensationalize and make it their discovery.
Mm-hmm.
There are, right now, you'll see publications, the Wine Spectator, for example, they won't review a wine I make.
No.
Their office is two doors down. Mm-hmm. You know, they'll give you different reasons and excuses, but you know, when somebody else is heading up the reviews at Napa, we may see somebody wanting to review.
Mm-hmm.
If they know I've made a wine for somebody else, I tell people, I say, don't. If you're sending this Spectator, don't. I don't know what. There was a problem with Parker for years because I fired a buddy of his that was a friend of his that was our distributor that didn't pay his bills. And I had to drop him. And I went from the fair-haired boy, I was a discovery back in the 80s, to being not reviewed for 6 years.
Wow.
Now, they do review me now, of course. And I have gotten some pretty good reviews recently, but my highest rated wines worldwide from the 90s weren't even reviewed by him. And if they were, if one of them or two of them were, he would criticize them as being too oaky and when there was no oakiness to them at all, or something else. And I became kind of, I guess, a personal thing. I'd like to think we're past that. And I do submit through the Napa vendors, because they collect wines from them. And I've got some nice reviews. Not always maybe under, but they weren't under my name. So I don't know. You're dealing with politics in some cases. I'm not the only guy that the Spectator won't review.
Right.
They don't talk a lot about some of the long-term producers because you're old news. Even though there's a new company, you're old news.
That's unfortunate.
They're always looking for that new, brightest, youngest, this and that. And that's great, but do we forget about some of the people that are still doing it? Not, I'm not taking me out of the subject.
Uh-huh. How do you feel it impacts the consumer? At the end of the day, in my humble opinion, consumers they're the ones that are paying the bills and buying
right.
things. So is there a disservice there when we're forgetting about some of the foundational aspects of the wine industry and that breadth and depth of experience we covered in this conversation? Is this constant need to centralize and new and shiny that you know pursuit of something that's new for the sake of newness?
Yeah.
Is that, how does it impact the consumer?
The new consumers don't know what's new and what isn't.
True.
The middle ground of consumers without having to label, you know, baby boomers, Gen X, and millennials, and all that. Everybody wants to. I don't like to even put people into that kind of box because I think of it more as what's your experience with wine as opposed to what your generation is.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are baby boomers that have picked up wine in the last few years that really may be no different than a millennial in terms of their wine exposure and wine knowledge and how that all relates to them and what do they know. I think the history and really the American wine history really is more concentrated probably in the years that I've been in the business than at any other point. I mean, that history is not known. Yeah, it's now, I've had a lot of people ask me about, you need to write this down, you need to make notes, you need to write a book, blah, 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 because I'm somewhat of a transitional person. Mm-hmm. When I came in the business, the great legends, of which there were few, but the great legends, I got to meet, know, taste, and socialize with them and learn a lot. Because I also was willing to want to do that. I talk to people at a function, I'll mention a name, nobody even knows what I'm talking about. And it's a pretty important part of the world.
How is this a society, and certainly as a microcosm of it in the wine world, doing ourselves a massive disservice by not getting to know the foundational piece of our history? We're a young culture, but we're an important culture, and the world looks up to us.
Right.
So why are we not pursuing the obvious, which is there's nothing new that gets to be invented in any realm? You're repeating a lot of history, and those who don't know history are doomed to repeat it. That is still true. So people like you, really, their voices should be heard loud and clear, because you have experienced so much, and you have learned and were mentored, whether, you know,
consciously
and purposefully, or just by osmosis, by some of the people that created the foundation that so many now are, again, consciously or unconsciously deriving a lot of success from.
Yeah. You know, I would like to think that at some point, you know, there are people that will look back and want to investigate what's going on, what's happening, why did these wines become what they are, and whatever. And it's a natural thing, more natural for them to look into Europe to that. But when we talk about the American customer and the new customer, they don't really know how far back wine went or whatever. There are some things, and unfortunately I won't be here for it, but there's a film on Telechef that's gonna be coming out and being featured at I think it's a Jarvis coming up in.
Is it Andre?
Yeah.
It did a limited run, and I'm glad that it's coming up again.
Yeah, I haven't seen it, and I would like to see it. They're doing a thing here in Napa, and I can't be there for it because I've got to be in Georgia the whole week, and I can't change that. I think things like that are great, but he wasn't the only guy. I mean, who doesn't give a shit? Well, nobody knows John Daniels except for Robin. Robin Lael and her sister, you know. Nobody experienced those wines.
Why is it so
Coppola hard? Might, because he was a huge fan of what went on in England, and that's why he bought the founders' homestead behind the winery years before he was able to buy the vineyard and the winery, and that was years before he was able to buy the name. And I tell people this, I said, you don't realize he bought the winery and the vineyards around the winery for something between $9 and $11 million. I don't remember what exactly, but it's easy to find the numbers. And then years later, he spent more than that to buy 9 letters.
How about that? Well,
Engelhook, the name, was owned by jug wine producers. It was not done. That way he's reestablished the name, the home vineyard, and the founder's vineyard.
He restored it to its original.
He's got it now. It's called Legal Look again.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Yeah.
But if somebody like Coppola sees so much value in that, clearly there's a lesson to be learned. And philosophically speaking, I've always wondered, why is it that we're so wedded, I don't know what the genesis of that is, to glorify old world as a wine culture, both internally and externally, meaning on the trade and consumer side. But we're so quick to forget our own.
Yeah, yeah, that's that, that's it's hard to know why that is. Maybe because it's never been fully evolved. Maybe there really isn't a good history coming forward. I mean, people do this and that, but you know, it and what the acceptance is, I don't know. Everybody does feel tied to the old world.
Right.
Even if they're only drinking new, except for, again, the youngest generations,
right,
which, you know, learn that. But, and some of that, it's hard in the East because the East was more tied to Europe than the West.
It feels almost like a foregone conclusion. All equals some kind of primal comfort zone. They must know what they're doing.
Right.
And new cultures kind of get battered for being new.
Right. And interestingly enough, the old world learned a lot from the new world about making wines and making better wines over, in the winemaking process.
And you highlighted experimentation.
And the machines are made in Europe.
Right.
See? So it goes, you know, they made them there for us, and then we learned stuff, and they learned from there, and they move, and, you know, it's kind of interesting.
And you highlighted experimentation as
maybe it has to do with the royals, you know, people are into.
I'm not sure if it's just some sort of, again, primal that we're wedded to something,
yeah,
that's our comfort zone and on some level that's subconscious. But I've always felt that in Europe they were highly limited and heavily regulated when it comes to experimentation, both by
right,
virtue of geography, land, and the government. That, and also, you know, there's a million reasons why they couldn't pursue that piece of it. Whereas in the new world at large, and certainly true in California, and you brought it up, you said, I continue to experiment. I assume that involves all kinds of aspects of production. I assume it involves, you know, fermentation vessels and closures and,
We're always testing yeasts and we're testing,
different
types of barrel treatments, mm-hmm, different types of things. If somebody can sell me on the fact of what the reason is, and it makes sense to me, then it should be worth experimenting. I did a lot of experimentation at my old winery. But we got into bigger production. It was much easier to do. I tested the first barrels made in France that were imported here especially for Sauvignon Blanc and Semillon. And as being the first one, I had to allow other winemakers from other wineries to come in and taste through, because I had other wines with this. I had other that grapes in other barrels that they may have been more common to them and more common to me. And they could actually taste the differences. As a general statement, I say, because we know that individual barrels can be slightly different on their own from themselves, but I'm just talking about a more generalized tasting.
Well, clearly your longevity in the industry ties very heavily to your life's philosophy, which, again, good old-fashioned values, not resting on your laurels at any point in your career.
Yeah.
And moving forward, what are your hopes and what are your plans for your own brand and the brands you're consulting for?
I never think that far ahead.
Okay.
I've been that way all my life. I'm concerned about now and today and what's going on and in the near future. It's because that's positive energy that you can use. If you get into trying to plan a future far off, you don't know you'll even get to that point. And what does that mean? Well, where does it go from there? There are so many things. We don't know what the world's going to be like. We don't know where it's going to be, what's going to happen. So you have to you always want to be at the front edge of thing. And I've predicted the advance of other varieties before, like I did with Pinot Gris. I projected that to a lot of people. I've projected other things. What's going to happen next? Whatever. In fact, at the time, back when I first pegged Pinot Gris, I told people it would be that it would definitely be the number three white wine, could develop to be the number two white wine in this country.
Wow.
And everybody thought I was, when people think you're crazy and you're goofy, then you know you're on the right track. Especially if there's common sense to that choice. So, but, so I'm looking at those windows. Where do we go? You know, try and still, I try to make each wine better than the last, and at the least make it equal. I don't like to go backwards.
No, for sure.
You know, now, with big companies and big industry, you have to do that, or you have to start, and that's why there's being more wine made in the lab. You know, and unfortunately, it's being made by some used to be big names. And they're still big names. People buy a certain brand of Cabernet of Valley because they've known it for 40 years. And they, oh, it's rare, you got to get it. And it used to be collected by all the winemakers. And nobody has collected it for a decade among the winemakers because they don't barrel age it like they used to. And they add concentrate and make it. And it's got distinguishable sugar and all. But some people still buy it because they think they're supposed to have it, because they read it. And so I tell people, don't taste more than you read. Reading reviews from one or two publications does not tell you anything. It doesn't, you know, you need to learn past that. It only gives you an indication to look at stuff, but when you see the same stuff going on and on, you gotta learn more, you know, anyway. I would hope that, well, I mean, social media is actually a new part of the world that actually is expanding people's thoughts and minds. I remember when the internet came out and said, well, you're gonna sell something online? I go, sell something online, you put it online. You don't sell anything online. You know, well, nowadays, not necessarily in the wine business,
right,
but in the world, that's a big deal.
I think so. It certainly have flooded
yeah.
us with all kinds of information. It becomes challenging, I think, for an average person to navigate their way, to discern quality, insightful data from just absolutely self-serving and random
yeah.
things. But, you know, the onus, I guess, is on you to find those things that are salient.
Well, you know, one of these, like working with the people that I work with in my own brand, Pure Crew, and also, and clearly with the Jay McClellan and the Lost Chapters, is the continuous elevation of the wines, the development. And we're never going to change the world because we're not making that kind of production. We're not going to have the biggest publications write about it, because we're not sexy enough. But I challenge any of these people to put on vertical tastings going back 20, 30 years and invite me against the wineries of your choice. And maybe you'll learn something. Because when you read reviews and you say, oh, and it's going to be, you know, drink by 2020. I've read reviews recently on some wines where I didn't know it, but I have numerous wines that supposedly have been dead and gone for 10 or 15 years. One of them's still growing, and several of them are maybe the most perfect they've ever been. But they weren't going to make it. So in making wine, so for me, and part of maybe a legacy, is that some of these wines that we're making on the Jay McClellan wines, and that brand potentially, because of the family, could be around longer than Pure Crew. Those wines, and I hope it's the case, because I hope it goes on for generations, that they will build their identity, but every year we need to make sure that those wines have that ability. Yes, they want to sell them, but I want to make sure.
You built them a stamina in mind.
Yes. I want to make sure that you can drink them. These are not like the Howell Mountain wines from years ago where, oh man, when the tannins soften, these wines are going to be great. So people were putting them away for 20 years. The problem is the fruit dies before the tannin decreases in a lot of those wines. I mean, not all. So some of the really hard tannic wine, don't buy it because a wine should be drinkable when it's released. It doesn't have to be the best it's going to be, but you have to like it at that point. And if it's balanced properly, it'll just get better over time. And don't think white wines can't. Unfortunately, a lot of white wines today are made to, drink before tomorrow. And I don't like to make wines that way.
Well, I think that's wonderful, and I think that's almost like an insurance policy that if you're investing in a wine, then you're not necessarily forced to drink it early on. You actually can't afford to put it away, and it will become something else. So it will develop.
Yeah. And that's what I tell people too, and I instill that in the people that I consult for.
Well, that's a wonderful philosophy, and for those that are listening and are making purchasing decisions, I really want to hear from you. You touched upon tasting as a means to becoming better at what you do. I believe it applies to consumer. I believe that perhaps rather than trusting other people's opinions, whether they're seasoned publications or a less prominent and often flighty opinions, that perhaps empowering their own palates is the way to go, and the way to do it is what you've accomplished through your life experience.
I have a great little story about that. When I taught the wine class for 5 years in Modesto Junior College, that was 79 to 84. That's right. It wasn't 77. So, I still get people to come up to me that took that class. And say, oh, I remember when you did. I remember that you did that. Well, really? But I remember tasting people on wines, and we do blind tasting. Try to instill that. And the people that were the most critical of a certain wine, because we would discuss it before we'd unveil it. We talk about what's good, what's where it's supposed to be. So the ones that were the most critical of a particular wine, number four, that wine, when we unveiled it, oh my God, that's the wine I drink. That happened almost every time. I mean, not every class, but it was amazing how that, and because people get so locked into their own comfort, I said, so all you drink is Almaden Mountain Nectar, whatever. Going back into, you mentioned that today, people have no idea what they're talking about. Almaden was huge in those days. But anyway, or you could pick a number of wines that I don't want to mention right now that are very popular and they're, made in a certain style that, it's like Coca-Cola. And people won't taste those wines. I was doing the V Foundation big tasting that they had on the Friday night before the auction. That's the Jimmy Valvano, the Foundation for Cancer Research. One of the most successful charity auctions you could ever have. I mean, and most. I was the first donor because I knew who Jimmy Valvano was. When they came to Napa, people didn't even know who he was. I said, I watched him win the championship, when North Carolina State won the NCAA championship. I knew who he was. I knew, So, anyway, I was the first donor. And now, when you go to the event now, you can't even tell I was a donor because all the big people jumped in and spent a fortune, and that's fine, but they know who the first one was. Got it started. Yeah. So, anyway, they're doing an event, and a certain very popular Napa Chardonnay is pouring next to me, and all these, how do I say it? middle-aged women were running over to taste and then go and then come back and taste and go and back. And I said to one of them, I go, I said, oh, this is our favorite wine. We love this wine. I go, we're to tasting. You have 100 and some wines to taste. It's a discovery. You don't get to do this all the time. I said, to come here and just drink your favorite wine when you have all this opportunity, frankly, is a waste. But do what you want to do. And that happens so much. If they would have just, you know, and they go, people go around and taste things. And your palate is not always the same. Some of these people, it's like soda pop to them. They're just drinking it because it's the same product all the time. Well, you might be surprised. You may find a lot of things you like a lot better. And you don't have to quit drinking it. You just don't have to drink it and everything else. And if you're really having wine with food, you can't be eating really great food if you're drinking sweet wine, unless it's food made to go with a sweet wine. Anyway, so I still, but I, you know what? I just say, screw it, I'm gonna tell them the way it is. So I say things here that people go, nah, the hell with it. What does it matter to me? I'm telling the truth. And you know what? Once in a while, people get it. And then I always hear from them later. And they always thank me for opening their eyes to different things. It doesn't have to be my wine. Just, you see me, I make wine. I go out and I'm tasting these other wines myself. I mean, that's what it's for. It's a great discovery. So, you know, you have to, you have to break people's habits sometimes, but wine is the perfect thing to do that with. And, but sadly, you know, the big guys are big because they just become big, you know. I mean, there's a winery up here in San Luis, the Franciscan, that doesn't label Franciscan. Franciscan doesn't exist. I didn't realize that till recently. When I drove by and I go, it's the Prisoner Winery? Oh my God.
Thank you, Mitch, so much for your wisdom, for the gift of critical thinking, which I believe is a foundational skill that everyone should partake in, and certainly for the teachable moment, there it is, challenge yourself, challenge your palate, don't go along with the established parameters that may or may not be who you truly are.
Well, I just want to kind of, in closing, point out that if I'm involved in the production of a wine, it's going to be a real wine. It's going to be enjoyed by a wide range of people, which has had more fun doing that than anything. Two people, I have husband and wife, they have opposite tastes. And when you can serve something that they both like, and then I get thanks for that a lot, because you expose people to different things, bring them to it. If I'm involved in a production of a wine, and of course, right now, that's obviously Pure Crew. The Jay McClellan, which is fun, and that always, every one we're doing, a fourth wheel, it's always going to be a new kind of thing that we're doing. And then the Lost Chapters, which is experimental results that can lead to some fun things. And then the wines that I also do for Gabrielle O'Connell, the O'Connell family wines, they're all going to see things. And I have people that are fans of all of those. Well, they're fans of all of those because why? They're different. They're good. They have the ability to age. They have beautiful balance. And you can eat with them. You can drink them by themselves. And you can eat with them. And you know that, and if there's one thing that I'm most proud of, is if I'm behind it, it's going to be a wine that is not going to go bad. You know, chances are, unless you store it improperly, it'll be good for a lot longer than you'd ever hold it for. And that's the way the brands continue. That's the way the labels continue. You know, I think Descato's and John McClellan, you know, gave me an opportunity beyond what I was doing, even for myself and for others, to allow that to move on. And I came in working with the first wines that I didn't ferment and making some changes. And they have, I had full carte blanche to do that. And that means they have to believe I'm right in what I'm doing. But I have the proof behind it. I open up wines for people, friends or gatherings, or sometimes we'll, the other night we did a tasting here. I will do a tasting in here where people have actually brought some of my old wines that they had, and then I'll bring something older that I made that they never had a chance to. And when they see that and they taste that, that doesn't make them, oh, I wish I could have that one. It's great. But they know that the process continues and will do so.
Very important. Well, there you have it. The links to all the brands that were discussed in this podcast will be on the website, www.calexposure.com. And thank you again, Mitch, for your company. It's been an honor to speak to you today.
Well, thank you, and it was a pleasure. The nice way to spend a Sunday morning. Do we tell people that?
Absolutely. Yes. It's a perfect Sunday morning.
Yes.